Hello and welcome to Boring Beige Box, the weekly podcast about retro computing. I'm your host, Matt Wilson. If you like to hack away at your autoexec.bat or config.sys files just so you can play King's Quest or Ultima, you're at the right place. From 2400 baud modems to IBM PS1s, to Monkey Island 2, to the Sierra Network, we cover it all if it happened in the 80s and 90s. So clean out that garage, pull out that old boring beige box, and let's have some fun. Hello, and welcome to another edition of Boring Beige Box. This is episode 15 for September 23rd, 2006. Our website is www.boringbeigebox.com. You can email me directly at podcast@boringbeigebox.com. You can also get involved in our forums. We have online forums. You can go to them directly at forums.boringbeigebox.com. Well, how's everyone doing? It has been a couple weeks since I have done the last show. Things have been pretty hectic, pretty crazy. A lot of stuff going on with the end of the summer and moving into the fall season. My wife is actually changing jobs, so we've been very busy with that kind of stuff, and I've just been busy. But I'm back and ready to go. We have a great episode. Today's topic is the Macintosh. That's right. We will be talking about the Macintosh computer from the beginning to what it currently is today. That's all in today's show. First off, I want to mention a little bit about the last episode. You know, was talked about the garage sale that I was having. And did have the garage sale a couple weeks ago. It went very well. We made a good bit of money. You know, actually, it was very good. We made about $400 or so. But mostly, it was just, you know, I sold a bunch of CDs, and we had tons of clothes we sold, and the whole neighborhood had garage sales. So it was pretty good. I did not sell very many retro computer items. I think I sold an old laptop I had. And that was about it. I mean, I had a full setup. It was a IBM Aptiva with a monitor, and it was like a Pentium 2 or Pentium 3. I mean, it was a great little like system just to play around with, your typical boring beige box, you know, that you could take home and fool around with in the garage, and it ran great. It had Windows 98. It was a great system. I was selling it just for $50. Nobody bought it, so. Oh, well, and I had tons of other systems. I had them all set out on the sidewalk, probably about four or five different older, like, 486 machines and 286, 386, and nobody bought them. So, oh, well, more for me to keep and play around with. So, yes, it went very, very well, the entire garage sale. Well, let's take a look at, I did get an email from a guy named Chad. And he wrote in, and I will read his email. And his subject, I really enjoy the podcast. Thanks so much, Chad, for writing. Like my headline states, I really enjoy the Boring Beige Box podcast. I grew up in the Beige Box era, and it's great to hear that other people remember the era as fondly as I do. I remember my first box, a 386 with a 13-inch monitor that my sister's boyfriend gave me when he upgraded to a 486. Honestly, I think my dad paid him for it. But I grew up in the early 1990s, and while we had an Apple Macintosh Performa, I'll mention those today, I didn't really get into computers until I discovered Bungie Software's Marathon. That was a classic game on the Macintosh, which I would bring my friends over to check out and compare it favorably to Doom. I remember very distinctly buying Wolfenstein 3D and Dune 2, just based on how cool the boxes looked. That's always, when you're young, you always buy stuff based on how cool the box looks. I remember how proud I was to finish Secret of Monkey Island, the first one, over the course of my summer vacation. That's just a great memory, I'm sure, for you, Chad. When I finished Monkey Island 2, that was the greatest feeling in the world. So, it was a tough game. I followed the adventure games pretty steadily up until Grim Fandango, which most LucasArts adventure game people stopped about that time, on my newer Pentium 2. While it won PC Gamer's Adventure Game of the Year, I think that if it won Game of the Year over Half-Life in 1997, we'd have many more adventure games today. It's possible. I picked and choose with my first-person shooters, Doom, Duke Nukem, and eventually Half-Life. I picked up Halo for my PC a while back. I figure I'll just run it on my new MacBook Pro. But the box remains unopened. I've stuck with my strategy games through the years. I have a great story about playing the original Command & Conquer from DOS in the school's computer lab because it was the only network we had access to, and actually getting in a lot of trouble for staying until 8 p.m. to play Command & Conquer with my friends. Now that sounds like fun. I'd mention Oregon Trail, but I don't want you to be all up all night. Yeah, Oregon Trail is classic. I own several computers over the years, several IBMs, which is what I've always called PCs. I get this from my dad, and occasionally this has been embarrassing, like when I asked a Best Buy salesman where the IBM-compatible joysticks were and just got a blank stare. Yeah, no one really says IBM-compatible anymore, except for old-timers like us or even older people. A few Macs and a Commodore 64 I picked up for $10 at a yard sale. Yeah, we're always getting C64s. And it came with Pitfall, Frogger, and Spy Hunter. Anyways, the era had a strong enough impact on me that I decided to pursue a career in game design once I finished college. And what DOS user doesn't remember bad command or file name? Oh, yeah. Thanks for the great podcast and keep up the good work. I really enjoy it. Chad, formerly of California, now in Savannah, Georgia. Thanks, Chad. Thanks for writing in. I really appreciate that. Now, that just shows, you know, so many people, I think, have some of the same type of memories that we do, you know, that, I mean, there's so many of us that kind of grew up in that era and, you know, fell in love with computers, in the, you know, late 80s, early 90s. And, you know, for me, I had been using computers as early as, when I was in third grade, which was in the 80s, like 1985, 1986. So I'm, to a lot of people, if you come from, or if you listen to Retro Bits by Earl Evans, you know, I probably sound like a young whippersnapper. You know, really, his era or that Earl talks about is more of the 70s and 80s, and even earlier than that. And that's kind of his generation. And like I've said before, with this podcast, I want to cover that later generation. And for a lot of you who are younger listeners, experiencing that growing up, and really having your first experience with computers in the late 80s or early 90s. Now, granted, I was, when I got my first computer, I was in high school. I was, you know, 10th or 11th grade in 1992. But I constantly followed computers and worked with them as early as the mid 80s. So, but for most of us that I think that listen to this podcast, you know, you, and even if you didn't grow up or you weren't a young person during the early 90s, even if you were older, you still experienced a lot of new worlds and new fascinations with your PC, with your boring beige box, especially, you know, connecting online and doing stuff like that. So, you know, those experiences you can take with you forever. It's almost like a magical time when you're really exploring the world. To me, I think that just the whole era of the online service with America Online, CompuServe, Prodigy, you know, the Sierra Network, that world to me was so much more fascinating than what it is today. I mean, today everyone accesses the web and, you know, email is nothing. Email is just like now we have text messaging and it's just a way of communication. Now the things that I still am fascinated with on the web is the new generation of websites of the web, like they call it Web 2.0. And it's really about, it's not about the technology, I feel, it's more about the community. So things like Wikipedia, I think to me are fascinating because you really explore any topic that you can think about. And, and also, you know, finding communities based on that. You can still use Google to look up, you know, certain websites and, just the whole idea of how online communication has evolved, like through online message forums, you know, message boards, and I guess as the older I get, you know, the more I forget how we communicated and how we did things back in the day, back in the 90s, and you know, how arcane it was, you know, to be on like America Online and some of those services. But nowadays, you know, when I look at communities, I see a lot of communities surrounding online gaming, whether it be, you know, fast-paced Counter-Strike type games, or, you know, action games, or either, you know, even a bigger community, which I always see is surrounded around multiplayer games or MMORPGs, which I've talked about in earlier podcasts. There, I mean, if you look at the community of World of Warcraft and some of the other ones, like there's another one coming out pretty soon called Vanguard, which is by the creators of EverQuest. There's such huge communities around these games. So I think community is very, very important in the online world. When you're at home, you know, you leave your day of work and you're away from everyone, and you know, you have your friends, you have your family, but you still want to have a connection with people that have the same interests that you do. The only way to find those people is online. You know, there's lots of times that I've tried to look for other people like me in my local community where I live, and there's not a lot of people. You know, I'm the, like most of us, you know, we're the typical geeks. You know, we like fantasy novels or science fiction novels, and we like to play, you know, online games, or we like to play computer games. We mess around with our computer. We, you know, we like Star Wars and Star Trek and typical geek stuff. And I'm constantly looking for other people like that in the community, and it's very hard. There's not a lot of people like that. Or either they're kind of embarrassed, or they don't want to talk about it, or so it can be hard to find people like that. But online and through message boards and even chat rooms like our IRC or something, or now the modern day chat room is like within some of these games, you can really reach out and interact with those people. So anyway, I don't want to get off on that too much, but there's definitely a lot going on out there. So something else I wanted to talk about was just mention a little bit some of the things. These are just some random thoughts I've kind of been enjoying over the past couple weeks. If you noticed, you know, I had a show recently on LucasArts, and I talked about some of the LucasArts games. I didn't really touch on too much of the Star Wars games. Now, LucasArts obviously has done dozens of Star Wars games since they've been around. And recently, I think just this week, the original trilogy, Star Wars trilogy, was re-released on DVD separately, and each one has the special edition and then the original edition that is unaltered, without all the special changes that Lucas did. The original ones that we saw, you know, it's very minor changes, but for some people it's a big issue or a big deal. So I was reading some online about that, and this is how much people like us are geeks and stuff that really get into the details. I'm amazed at how nitpicky people are about the differences between the special edition Star Wars and the original theatrical release Star Wars. You know, I have the special edition on DVD when they came out in the 4-pack set, the black box thing, back a year or so ago. And, you know, I watched through them, the special editions, and the changes are really, really small. There's not a lot of big changes, so it doesn't really make a difference to me. The other thing is that in these new DVDs that were released, the original editions that are on there, people are saying, you know, that they are like they were pretty much in the 70s and 80s, that there's no 5.1 surround sound, it's just 2-channel audio, and it is, the film quality's grainy, and it's, you know, it's not that great. It's not like real letterbox or real widescreen. So it's basically the exact transfer that came from the laser discs that came out years and years ago. But hey, you know, I mean, that's, if they wanted the original, that's pretty much how it was. But anyway, people get so nitpicky about that stuff. So I was playing, because of kind of getting interested in Star Wars, I was playing some Star Wars games. Now, I tried this out in the beginning when it first came out. If you've heard of it, Star Wars Galaxies, which is a MMORPG set in the Star Wars universe. And I enjoyed it when it first came out. It was pretty cool. But I got tired of it. It felt very pointless and kind of boring. And so I revisited it, and it was kind of fun. I enjoyed it. They made a lot of changes to it. But after playing it for, a couple days, it felt the same way. It's like, what is the point to the game? It's very pointless. There's not, there isn't the same, I like crafting and doing things in the game, building things and working on that kind of stuff and making money. But it just has, there's like no use for that kind of stuff anymore. It's pretty pathetic. Everything is now surrounding around player versus player. And it just seems like to me that it would take forever to get up to a high enough level to even do player versus player. So I just said, forget this. It's not even like the quests are not interesting. The towns feel like ghost towns. I mean, I just don't think there's that many people playing anymore. So, gave up on that. I also played Star Wars Battlefront, which is pretty good. Battlefront and Battlefront 2, which are pretty good. But anyway, Star Wars, I think, for me, is really just good in watching the movies. Some of the books are good. That's about it. So I was thinking about that. There's another thing. There's another podcast I listen to that I think you guys really like. It's called Stuck in the 80s. And if you do a search for it on iTunes or on the web, it's just the Stuck in the 80s podcast. It's done by some radio disc jockeys. They are writers for, they live in Tampa, Florida, and Tampa Bay, Florida, and they write for the newspaper there. Anyway, do a search for Stuck in the 80s. They have many, many shows they've done, and they talk about all kinds of topics that were covered in the 80s. It's great. I mean, they talk about movies and music and a little bit of technology. I mean, it's a really great podcast. I love it. Alright, well, I think that's it. Let's go into our main topic, the Macintosh. I wanted to cover the Macintosh computer today, because I have not touched on that yet, and I was just thinking about what could be a great topic, to kind of cover, because the Macintosh is actually where the original term boring beige box came from. There was someone who wrote in an article, years ago, that I think it was in the 90s that talked about the Macintosh being, calling it a boring beige box. And it was the era where Steve Jobs was out of the picture and the company was run, I think it was, I think his name was Scully or I forget his name. Anyway, John Scully, who was the CEO. And, what happened was their line of systems became very uninspired and, everything was with a number. It was the whole era of the Performa, the Apple Macintosh Performa, and the Quadra and all the different, everything had a number system to it. And you really couldn't tell the difference between the different models, so other than their numbers. So it was not very, they didn't have like one, I mean, it wasn't as specific as the whole Macintosh original line, the Mac Classic and the LC, but even moving into that, the LC, LC2, all that stuff started down that road of, they were boring beige boxes. They didn't have any like heart and soul to them, kind of the way that Steve Jobs originally envisioned. So that's where that term came from, actually. This is kind of, if you're into computers, you know the history of the Macintosh. 1984 is when they released the original Mac, and there was a big deal about the commercial during the Super Bowl that was kind of an Orwellian, George Orwell novel that was called 1984, and it was the idea of, defeating Big Brother and having and Big Brother kind of being like IBM. And the Macintosh was the way out of this oppression. It was very, it was definitely a change in computing history. The Mac was, for me, I think that it was a different way to use a computer. It was obviously graphical, had a graphical interface. You could point and click, and you know, you could use different fonts. You could do all these different kinds of things that you just never could do this kind of stuff really with DOS. And it was definitely a big change. So my experience with the Mac was, I would say it began with the Mac Classic. This was, you know, the all-in-one box with the 9-inch screen, but it was more advanced than the original Mac, and it was around 1989 when I believe that came out, and I began using the Mac Classic in 1991. So my first experience was pretty cool. In my high school, we had an area that was specifically designated as a writing lab for the English department. So we had all of these Macintosh Classic computers. They were mainly Mac Classics, and I believe there was one Macintosh 2CI, which I knew was incredibly expensive. It was a huge, monstrous, you know, desktop unit, and the monitor was like a 12-inch monochrome monitor, which was huge, you know, compared to the little Mac 9-inch black and white monitor. So all of the computers were available to be used for writing papers. Well, I had different ideas. I decided, and I probably have told this story before in earlier podcasts, but I decided to install SimCity, the original SimCity, on all of the Mac Classics. So what happened after that was pretty crazy. Everyone began playing SimCity when they should have been writing their English papers. And I got in pretty big trouble for doing that. But I even, you know, I copied the, they had a copyright, and this is so funny. When you think of copy protection for games in the early days, it was so pathetic. They had a card that you would have to, there was like, it was a red card with black lettering, and it had codes on it for certain cities. So when you were playing the game, it would ask you, put in this code. So it would, you know, make sure that you had not copied it to all the other games. Well, you could easily take that card and photocopy it, turn the brightness up really high, or the contrast on the copy machine, and make copies of it. So, made copies, gave it to everybody, and so everyone was happily playing SimCity. And, but that didn't last for long. They originally, you know, there was always some guy that was the, you know, teacher's assistant that kept an eye on everything, and, you know, jerkwad, he uninstalled the game on, you know, all the computers, and I'd put a bunch of other games on there, and finally I got banned from the writing lab, and I couldn't go in there anymore. So, but anyway, it didn't last that long, and I think they ended up getting rid of the lab and turning it into like a teacher's lounge or something, or a workroom or something. So anyway, it was a lot of fun. We spent a lot of time in there. You know, you could, the Mac Classics were awesome because like they had 16-bit audio, and you could play sound files, and I think I remember setting like some of the computers that every time you clicked on something, every time you did something, it made you know, funny noises or clips from movies like Star Wars or like the Three Stooges or something. And so it was we had a lot of fun in there. And there was one IBM PC in the corner, and I think it was like a 286, and I always tried to figure out, you know, how can I get it to work, how can I use this old IBM, and it was all DOS, and didn't even have a hard drive. It just ran off of floppy disks. And I remember having like Ultima 2 on floppy disk, on 5 1/4 floppy disk, but I never could get it to work. So anyway, the other thing is that this was around 90-91. I was in 9th grade, and I remember that I did not have my own PC yet, and so what I did was I purchased, and I think I've mentioned this before, I purchased Secret of Monkey Island 2 for the IBM PC 9 months before I even had my own PC. And I was so desperate to play the game that I tried to install it or tried to run it on the Mac Classic. And I knew that it didn't work on there, but I was just like, oh, maybe, just maybe it'll work on the Macintosh. And obviously it didn't, but I wanted to play it so bad. So I would say that probably being in that writing lab and using the Mac Classics really got me into computers. That was the start. I mean, I had used computers ever since, you know, the Apple II, which was a lot of fun. There was always one of them in a classroom, and even in like sixth grade, we had a computer class that were all Apple IIs, and we learned BASIC programming. And I did that, and I wrote some programs and stuff, and I remember copying stuff out of Byte magazine and typing everything in BASIC, and it took forever. And so I kind of did that a little bit, but it was more like this, okay, this is a class. This is, you know, I just do this. I don't do anything at home. You know, at home I was playing this, you know, Sega Genesis or the Nintendo or Super Nintendo. But, and then like in 7th and 8th grade, there were other computer classes I took. I think 8th grade we had a room full of Apple IIGSs, and we did like desktop publishing. But it was all stuff that we just did at school. I never did stuff at home or all my free time. And so now with the Mac Classics, I was in the writing lab all my free time. You know, when I had a study hall or during lunch, I was actually like using the computers and really getting into them. So that began to increase my interest and bring up a desire for me to have my own computer at home. So I began to get magazines like PC, PC Sources was one, and Computer Shopper, the huge volumes, you know, the big Computer Shopper magazines, and just scouring them, looking and trying to decide, you know, what I wanted and, you know, how much money it would take to save up to get a computer. And there is no, that summer that I saved up for my first computer, there is no other time like that I will have ever experienced in my life. I mean, that was a point where I knew I really, really wanted something. I really wanted that computer, and I spent my entire summer saving up like $800. And that's nothing. I mean, I make that much in, you know, a week now. And I had to spend 3 months, you know, trying to save up to get a computer. And it was the only thing I wanted. I mean, it was I wanted it so bad. I mean, even before that, you know, during the time of the Mac Classics and being in the writing lab, I also would go over to my friend's house and use his IBM PS1, which I also, that's a system that I always enjoyed. And I did a whole episode, one of my earlier episodes, I talked about the IBM PS1. And you know, using that made me even want to have my own system even more. You know, it's like the idea when, you know, when your friend has like some video game system and you're always going over to the house to play. Like, I remember that when I had a friend that had the Atari, or had a ColecoVision. I had a ColecoVision, but he had all the best games. And so I was always wanting to go over to his house to play all his games. You know, so that desire was incredibly strong to have my own system. So the Mac Classics kind of started that obsession with computers. So moving down the line, you know, after I had my own system at home, that's what I mainly used. But at school, we began to use, you know, there were other Macs that came along. I was in my yearbook class. We used the Macintosh LC, which I actually have a Mac LC that I bought a couple months ago off eBay. For like $30 or something. I mean, it was very, very cheap, $50 maybe. And it does work. It's an awesome machine. And I have it in my garage. And it's, I think it's the Mac LC 2. But that was a great system. I remember it was full color. You could do, you know, you use Aldus PageMaker, which is now Adobe PageMaker, which I don't even think they use PageMaker anymore. It's become something else. But we used PageMaker to do layouts for our yearbook, and that was a very cool Macintosh. But they were very, I remember the teacher, the yearbook teacher, she was very strict. I could never put any games on it or do anything with it. So, and that was pretty much the end of my use of the Macintosh during that time period, because after that, all of the classrooms began to get these IBM EduQuest computers, which were basically just like 486 machines that were just IBM compatible machines. And that's where, you know, I first enjoyed playing Doom and Civilization. I remember putting Civilization on a computer and playing that after hours before even when I had my own computer at home. But these computers were faster than my home computers, so I would stay after and play on those. But pretty much after that, the Macintosh was not, I was not interested in it at all, because all of the games, this was at the, I think, the golden age kind of the IBM PC games in the early 90s, mid-90s, when all of your first-person shooters and a lot of your, you know, really good strategy games and, you know, there was a lot of really, Myst, that was, you know, the photorealistic type of adventure, all the adventure games, all this happened in the early 90s, early to mid-90s, and so that's all I was into, and just getting online, America Online, all of that was on Windows format, everything was Windows. Windows was taking over, and it was all the way up into Windows 95, and so the Macintosh was the last thing of mine. That was the low point of the Mac, really, in the early 90s, mid-90s. And so the Mac didn't, you know, the Macintosh didn't really make a comeback until Steve Jobs came back and the new, the iMacs, came about, you know, the Bondi blue, the different colors. There was like a color for every, they called them different flavors, you know, and the Mac made a comeback. And the all-in-one system became popular again. And so many college students had these little iMacs and they went through the roof. Thanks to Steve Jobs, you know, who was, I mean, he is Apple. He is Macintosh. So, he's more Macintosh, I think, than Apple. Apple, when I think of Apple, I think of Apple IIs. I know that the company is Apple, and they make Apple IIs, and they make Macintosh, but Steve Jobs, the way that he is, the way that, you know, his, I guess you could say his psyche is, or who he is, like I think of the Macintosh, and his design for computers is the Mac. Apple IIe is more like the Woz, like Wozniak, Steve Wozniak, and his design. But the Macintosh is Steve Jobs. So when the iMacs came back around 98 or late 90s, everything changed, and Macintosh became cool again. And if you notice now, Macs are cool. Macs are very, very cool. And everyone, you know, tons of people use them for video editing. The Mac OS X is built on BSD, Unix, which is a very, very open way for a platform for the operating system. You can do so many stuff in it. Whenever I sit down to a Macintosh and I want to do something, boom, I go straight to the terminal window and I start typing in Unix commands because I can quickly see certain things that I want to find out about the system. Now, at my work, we have, like, you know, a few Macintosh. We have a Mac G4 for, like, a backup video editing system. The G5s are really cool. Like, right now, we want to move towards using the Mac G5, like, the quad processor. I mean, you can have, like, up to 8 processors, you know, using these quad and duo processor chips on the new G5. So we're probably going to move to that eventually in our editing department. But, you know, Macs are cool now. You know, people that, you know, you always see the Mac laptops, the MacBook Pro, now that they're using Intel chips, you can boot up, you can have Windows XP run on it, and you can have Macintosh. So the Macintosh computers are really cool. I mean, they've gone up in stock price, their stock is soaring. Their market share for computers has gone up. You know, the whole advent of the iPod and iTunes has just gone through the roof. I think that iTunes just this past week started selling movies on iTunes, and they sold like 1 million movies in like one day. They had 1 million downloads of movies in like day one. And that's insane. So you can see where technology is going. That's another thing I've been thinking about a lot. You know, the way that we view content, whether it be TV shows or movies or music, you know, things are definitely changing, and I think iTunes is at the forefront. And, you know, with such a big company like that, they have the power to make, to free the content, basically, to free up things that we want to watch, things we want to enjoy, and also, not just, you know, content that is paid for by studios, but content that is user content of us, podcasts, video and audio podcasts. I mean, we make our own content, and they support that. They're dedicated to, user-created content under the podcast section. So, you know, there's a lot of great things that have come out of the Macintosh and Apple, or out of Apple, and a lot of it has been brought from the Macintosh, you know, the advent of the Macintosh, and that whole spirit of technology and user-friendliness, I think, has all been based from the Macintosh computer. So that's it. So if you love Macs and you enjoy playing around with them, you know, definitely find an old system and have fun with the Macintosh Boring Beige Box. It's definitely, it'll take you back. I've had a Mac Classic off and on for many years. I've sold them, I've kept them. I had one recently, but I resold it. And they're fun little boxes to have. Some people turn them into fish tanks, or just use them just to write papers on, or play Glider. If you remember that Glider game, which you make a paper airplane and you can fly it, and you know. So anyway, they're definitely fun to have. All right, well, that about does it for the show. Thank you so much for listening. Email me, get on the forums. Just say hello, say that you enjoy the show. We have a lot of listeners. I think that we've continued to grow in our subscriber base. Our last show had 200 downloads, show 14, and most of the shows are averaging around 150 downloads every week. So now, like I said, it has been a couple weeks since the last one. I'm going to try to get back on track with a weekly basis. If not, just be patient with me. It may be every 2 weeks. But just keep an eye out on your podcasting software to see when the show comes up. All right, that's about it. Thanks so much, and have a great week. Bye-bye.